Hi, everybody. This is Mark Chaffardini with Go See Talk. Welcome back to the show. We are exceptionally happy to be speaking to our next guest. Composer John Powell has done it all, seen it all, written things from action adventures in space to animated bulls to spy thrillers to he's even found the road to El Dorado. Very excited to be speaking with this man of all trades. Mr. Powell, welcome. It's an honor to be speaking with you.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Well, we're experiencing some Hoth-like conditions in Dallas, Texas today. It's a little uncommon. How's the weather and the global climate in your neck of the woods?
I'm in Los Angeles, and it's, as usual, delightful. There will obviously be passing locusts and fires, and we've already got the pandemic, obviously. But other than that, it's fine.
I guess fire season doesn't really hold a candle to literally to the pandemic, does it?
No, it's much more fun.
Well, great. Let's take our minds away from bad things like that. Let's get into good vibes. Use the force, if we will. Before we get into A Galaxy Far, Far Away and this wonderful Mondo vinyl that's being released this year, let's go back in time. Maybe not as far as Bach, but what got you into music? What got your heart going?
Well, my father, he was a musician. He played in classical orchestras and on sessions, and he did films as well, things in the 60s. Those magnificent men in their flying machines, things with Ron Goodwin and, but he was in the RPO, the Royal Philharmonic, so he had a very varied classical career, but he was also into jazz and listen to lots of other kinds of music. So I think I was definitely influenced by what he was listening to, what he was playing. And it was one day particularly, he took me to a rehearsal of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. And that just sort of opened up the door to me seeing a language that explained a lot of things I couldn't explain with, I couldn't even think how to explain. But I seem to hear them communicated very clearly in the music. And, that's the thing about music. It's easy to speak. It's easy to understand. It's the language that speaks at a deeper level than any other kind of art even, and certainly than language. And I found myself to be entranced by that. And I've spent the rest of my life trying to learn how to speak it myself. Which is much harder than understanding it. It's a great universal language for comprehension, but to actually master is still proving very difficult.
Well, before you saw that performance of Mendelssohn, what type of music were you into, and was this a complete paradigm shift for you?
I've been listening to music, probably classical music. I played a bit of trombone even very early on, and lots of different things, but nothing really captured me quite as clearly. So I was just, a normal kid who was just probably more interested in other things, and having something like this come along that turned my head so completely was quite astonishing to me, I think. I was probably struggling with lots of things. And I was trying to understand religion. I remember and why people, I went to a Church of England school, as a lot of people do in England. You have, prayers and hymns in the morning. And I remember liking the music, but not understanding the words. I remember being puzzled by the words. So as I tried to figure out what religion was and what it was doing, and why the music in the hymns spoke to me but the words didn't, I think the Mendelssohn suddenly answered lots of questions that were so far beyond the words. I didn't need the words. I think it answered lots of questions of what my relationship with the universe was in a way that I couldn't even think about. I think that's the thing. I'm talking young, seven, and it's very hard to intellectually grasp many things at that age, but I'm listening to pieces of music that had a a story in them that seemed to explain, or at least show me that everybody else was, you know, the other people, in this case Mendelssohn, struggled with these questions, and they were answers that had, there were no words for. And so I think that's what I found to be such a paradigm shift for me.
Well, if we could use him and your dad's experience as a gateway, where did it go from there? What was the next step in that process?
Well, the next step is, you know, I tried learning the violin, which I proved to be quite able at, shall we say. I wasn't a prodigy. I was starting too late, really, for a prodigy, and I certainly wasn't good enough, but I was musical. So I think from there on, it becomes a question of, you know, then getting to play with other people in other, in ensembles, playing different types of music. I started to even write things on the violin. And as it got further and further, the realization that there was more and more that could be said, and, you know, people had said even, you know, more, you know, even deeper language was there to, you know, to learn and to hear. And to try and understand, and performing the violin seemed to actually be it was like a singing voice that I could try and master, even though I didn't have the, you know, the vocal capacity of actually making those sounds. So I think that's why I liked the violin. Eventually I changed to the viola. I also grew up a bit, became a teenager, and suddenly heard lots of other music other than classical music. So I remember Because the Night by, what's her name? It's a Bruce Springsteen song that Thingy Smith, that's terrible. Can't remember her name. It was a very famous song. And, you know, having been somebody who was listening only to, you know, a lot of Baroque at the time, but also I was really enjoying a lot of Tchaikovsky and things. To hear something that spoke to me, Patti Smith, to spoke to me that was in such a different language, and that was a shock. It was like, well, wait a minute, this, how does this work as well? You know, Kate Bush, Peter Gabriel, all of these other sort of types of music suddenly started to flow in to the pot. So I realized that it was something I really wanted to do, and I wasn't quite sure how, what, where, why. So I just pursued it, and then ended up at music college studying composition. And from there, again, still didn't quite know what I was going to do. But, you know, to survive, you find ways to make some money. And one of the ways I made money was to work in advertising music, what is commonly known as jingles, but I wasn't really writing jingles. I was just writing music that suited various adverts. And I enjoyed that. I really enjoyed that. And through that, I then met Hans, who had worked at the same company in London, and he brought me in to help on a few things. And my relationship with Hans was good enough that he invited me over to Los Angeles. And eventually I came, and, you know, the rest is history.
Well, you are charting some major history, working on films like the Bourne films. A couple of the first ones out of the gate for you were Face Off and then Ants and Shrek, which you did with another great composer we like, Harry Gregson-Williams. But let's go back a little bit to your father. You know, there's some times where when there's a profession in the family, sometimes it's discouraged, sometimes it's encouraged. What kind of support or maybe different direction were you offered?
Well, he was kind of old, so he was retiring, really. And he went from playing with the Royal Philharmonic and doing these sessions to just doing the odd session and, you know, a few things with what's called the BBC Concert Orchestra, which is a very kind of wonderful, varied orchestra that can play anything, really. They did some classical, but they also did lots of light music. And he was used to prefer that. So I didn't really get to see him at the peak of his profession. I mean, in the sense that I remember him coming back from a tour of Russia when I was very young. He'd been doing all the kind of the real classical highbrow stuff until I became interested in music myself. And then at that point, he was on the decline, really. He died when I was 15. So, which is a very common way for people to, in the arts, to then have, you know, this figure that you try and prove something to for the rest of your life. So, I mean, he gave me the advantage of some genes, a love, showing me, you know, a love of music. But he was never very, it was hard for him to encourage me. I remember he used to come in and listen to me practicing partitas, Bach partitas on the violin. And he would tell me about rhythm. You know, he was always very keen on rhythm. He was a tuba player, so he couldn't really get into any specifics of, you know, string writing or things. He was a brilliant musician. He was a very good musician, but I think he must have found it quite difficult for me to be scratching away, you know, in the kitchen with this, you know, these pieces and killing them. And one day he did say to me, he said, "You're going to make a very good plumber," and walked out, which was a terrible, terrible thing to say to me, but it probably helped. He also said, "Don't be a player, be a composer," because he said, "There's no money in playing." And he was right about that. And, you know, but he was a big stickler for time, for rhythm. And I did become very fascinated by rhythm. And, you know, I think a lot of my work, you know, has got an overemphasis, you know, it's overemphasizes my interest in rhythm, perhaps, and percussion in particular. So, you know, I think everything I needed was there in the, you know, the 15 years I was with him. But he, you know, he left an indelible mark. And I think I pursued things perhaps more with a greater tenacity to sort of try and prove something to him, even though I never could.
I gotcha. Well, you mentioned Hans Zimmer earlier, and you know, you did the Road to El Dorado with him. What were some of the first projects you worked on, and once you were in Los Angeles, and what were some of the things you started to learn by this process?
Well, the very first thing really was lots of song arrangements on Prince of Egypt.
Oh, okay.
And they were songs that Hans had, you know, was working on. I think at that point they'd only done the opening one, which is called Deliver Us, which is an amazing song, an amazing production. And so he needed help to try and flesh out the other songs. And, you know, we would talk through things, I'd try things out. And I got to see, you know, DreamWorks, and I got to meet Jeffrey Katzenberg and work in animation. And I'd always loved animation, never thought I'd be able to get into it. And that was how Harry had worked on the score as well of Prince of Egypt with Hans, and I'd worked on the songs. And I think Jeffrey Katzenberg had liked both of us and decided to put us together for Ants. That's how we got the Ants gig. But then one of the very first things I did with Hans as well was working on a film called Endurance, which really I started before Face Off, and was a film that was produced by Terrence Malick, who I didn't know, I must admit.
Oh, really? Really?
I didn't know his work, anything. I was just introduced to him with Hans, and he was the kindest man. He treated me like an artist, as he does to everybody. He didn't know who the hell I was, but he'd asked Hans to do, you know, Endurance, and he'd asked Hans to do his next film, which was Thin Red Line. So Hans was working on this, but he was also working on a few other things. So he asked me to help, and that was a very important one for me to try and show Hans that, you know, I could sort of come up with things that were, you know, very different from him. I mean, one of the things that Hans always liked was that I, even though I could sound like him, and it was a good business plan somewhat to, when required, sound like him. sure. I also could do things that didn't sound like him, and that's what Endurance was. I think he thought, oh, this kid's got has a voice of his own, because it's very different. And so from there onwards, then he gave me, you know, Face Off came in, he gave me that had definitely been one where it was more prudent to sound more like Hans. But from there onwards, it was one of these things of watching Hans, working with him, observing his techniques of writing, his techniques of understanding story, and his techniques of, you know, dealing with difficult questions in meetings and you know, and dealing with the stress of putting together so much music in such a short amount of time, getting it right, and being able to, you know, understand the story and be a, I think the real thing as well was to be creative, and be as much of a filmmaker as the filmmakers. Mm-hmm. You know, you're part of that team. You're not just a composer who's providing music. You are, you know, you really dive into the process of making the movie work as much as anybody on the team.
Sure. And I'm glad you mentioned there's a good racket to be made in Zimmer sound alikes, but I think what you said about Face Off, there's a little bit of Backdraft, there's a little bit of The Rock, but there's also a ton of heart. I mean, just that track Homecoming, that the sort of family theme that's woven throughout the film, it sort of brings it all together, because you can have gunfights and boat chases, but without that core element, it's missing. And it always gets me. So I'm thrilled to be speaking with you, because that's your work. That's really a statement. So, but moving from there, maybe take a step back. When you said you did the song arrangements for Prince of Egypt, one of my favorite tracks is Through Heaven's Eyes. Did you work on that one as well?
Through Heaven's Eyes, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I worked on about seven of them. And in the end, I think only a couple of the things I worked on went through Through Heaven's Eyes. I don't remember. I remember, is that the one with the two women singing, Michelle Pfeiffer and...
No, I think that's the one where Danny Glover's sitting around the fire.
No, that was Gavin. That was my friend Gavin did that one.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a few of us doing it. That was great fun. And Stephen Schwartz was wonderful. I mean, you know, he had to put up with, you know, a bunch of kids being sort of thrown at his songs. I mean, you know, he was used to doing it a certain way, I think. But Jeffrey wanted Hans to sort of have control, because they'd had such success on The Lion King. You know, he wanted Hans to sort of bring that, you know, sort of team into look at all the songs. And we some of my job was sometimes to prove that songs weren't needed, which is tough, you know. You know, so there was a few songs that went by the wayside that were very good, you know, but I touched most of them, I think, but even I can't remember half of them. I'm sorry. It's been a while. Really. I remember playing with the big boys, I think, something like that. I remember that one, a few of them, but it was one of those things where I had to try. It was hard. I had to try and make an impression on everybody and make sure things worked as well as I could. It was a huge responsibility. So every time you don't get one of the songs right, it was, you know, it would often be handed over to other people. So I think that one, I don't even know if I touched it. Gavin Greenaway is a composer, conductor who I have been working with since I was at college. I met him at college, and he and I have written a lot of music together. He's a brilliant composer we wrote a lot of music for art installations, and we were in a performance art group together, and we still write together an opera together, which we're renovating. It's about 25 years old, but we're renovating and rewriting it right now. So, you know, I was basically saying that because I don't want you to think at the beginning of my career, I was really any good at anything. I was pretty shit, actually. So I think probably I might have had a go at it and fucked it up, and that's why somebody else took over. That's the truth. You didn't expect the truth this morning, but you know the truth these things can be a bit crappy.
Well, it's great that you're honest. I mean, that means a whole lot more to me and the listeners. But you know, you've gotten your niche, or I don't want to say you're the animation guy, but you've got quite a lot of experience. And is there, I know it's just sort of it's a medium, it's not really a genre, but is there an art, is there something that you like about it? What is your mindset when you say, okay, I'm scoring animation? Are there different rules you make up?
Yeah, there are probably, but I remember, you know, not so much Prince of Egypt, but on Ants, Jeffrey Katzenberg gave us, Harry and I, a good talking to about, you know, you are not doing an animated movie, you're doing a live action. Treat this as a live action. And I always sort of hung by that. But at the same time, I do love Carl Stalling, who, you know, was the master of, you know, the Warner Brothers style, and Scott Bradley, who did the original Tom and Jerry. So I do like that style. And there's lots of early Disney stuff as well that's got beautiful, wonderful, beautiful music. The Mickey Mouse effect, which is Mickey Mousing, is a verb in film music terms, which is sticking too closely to the action. Obviously, when it's funny, it's funny, but it's a terrible thing to do if you do it in the wrong way. And it means that animation has a sort of a slightly different set of rules. There are things that you would never do in live action that you can do in animation, but there are also things in animation that, you know, you shouldn't ignore the fact that it's just a film, it's just a story. So you're doing the same kind of job, and you're trying to find the subtexts, things. And I think the thing that people dislike about Mickey Mousing and why it's actually not very useful often is that it's doing what you see anyway. So, but there's an effect in animation of making comedy with Mickey Mousing, with being very sort of tight to the picture. You can get a lot of, you can sort of make things funnier. But the thing that it doesn't do is it doesn't give you any subtext. So if the story has that need, if the story is deep enough and it has subtext, it's always better to try and pretend it's a, you know, any film at all. I mean, obviously I've worked on live action films, which have been, half of them have been animation, or, you know, what's called previs, which is kind of very, very rough animation, like block animation, just because they haven't finished shooting and they haven't finished the visual effects. It's hard sometimes to look at these films and know what the hell is going on when they're that early on. You really don't know. So I think the rules are, treat it like a story, but I do like animation because it has a lot more, I think the visuals are more important often in animation, because it's a bunch of artists, visual artists, who are making it. They can be, you know, depends, but you know, certainly the Dragon series, I think, had a wonderful reliance on visuals and acting. And with great animators, you get great acting. So I do enjoy that side of it. It's not talky, not as talky. There's more requirement for the music to tell, you know, to support the poetry of it. But I have done it because often it's hard to find live action films that I don't find to be offensive to me. and I've never really got the drama gigs, you know, the kind of the Oscar drama films, because I'm not really very subtle. I'm probably a little bit, I was recently described as being a muscular composer, which is, if you're flabby and overweight, it's great that somebody says that, but yeah, I think it can be, it means that I think I don't do that kind of film. I've done some romantic comedies and romantic films. I do like that side of things, but I'm probably a bit heart in the sleeve time, you know, somewhat with music. It's probably a bit overly operatic. I remember working on the only Marvel film, as it were, which was the X-Men film I did. And somebody saying, this score is very operatic, you know? And I took, at the time, I thought, well, that's very kind of him, but he didn't mean it that way. I think he meant, you know, you overcrank a bit, dude. So I hint that there's different types of films I don't get, and films that I don't want to do because I think they're too violent, really, often. I don't really like violent films that, where the violence is comfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, often you have a lot of violence where everybody's beaten the shit out of everybody, and really, you know, and there's not the devastation that there should be from that violence scene. You know, I'm always going on about this. So there's certain things I've avoided, certain things I probably don't get to do. And it seems that animation I'm okay at, and people like what I've done. And so why not? I do love it. I love watching the film sort of grow in front of me, because we start often with storyboards. You don't often get the film finish, even close to finish, when you start. The last 3 months of an animated film is exactly when all of the shots are coming in. And so I might start, you know, with 90% storyboards, and by the time I'm finishing, finally, you might have 90% animation, or maybe 100% animation, but not necessarily finished lighting and, you know, the final rendering. I often don't see the film properly until the premiere.
Well, I mean, one thing you said earlier was lacking a little bit of confidence, and you know, with each project you do, you kind of get the courage after it's over. But is there a project that you think that you were hesitant to start, and then once you got through with it, you really turned a corner, or you really developed your palette, or things really became John Powell?
Well, Bourne was a bit like that. Bourne Identity was definitely me trying to find a way of really finding my own voice for Hollywood to understand. You know, I'd been involved so much with Hans, you know, and I would never, you know, say anything other than every minute of that was useful and a wonderful experience. But I was very aware early on that he casts quite a big shadow. He's got a big hat, I would say. I remember going after Face Off, going to a meeting with a music head of music at one of the studios, who sat me down and said, "Okay, tell me why I need a cheap rate Hans Zimmer." I remember thinking, "You don't. Why are you saying that?" It suddenly made me realize, I'm going to have to try and make my own way here. And it proved to be difficult to sort of leave that world somewhat. So when I got the gig for Bourne, I remember thinking, this might be the director I can try some things on. And a lot of that was very the opposite of what was done in action films at the time. And obviously a big part of the majority of how action films were done at the time was remote control style, you know, Hans' style, everybody doing that. So I decided to do everything kind of opposite. It was opposite day on Bourne. Like all the sounds that we would normally use, I didn't use. The, you know, all the giant sort of cinematic sounds, I deliberately made everything the opposite. I made everything drier and smaller, and didn't use many forces, and didn't add much music. I tried to keep as much, you know, keep as many sort of moments of quiet or just sound effects. So that when the music was there, it had more of a, you know, more of an impact. And that was very much a, sort of a kickback to films I liked, to the action films with Michael Caine in the 60s and things, you know, Impress Files and things like that, you know, John Barry stuff. Well, there wasn't much music. That was the thing. There's not that much music in Bullet. there's not that much music in things that Jerry Goldsmith would have scored. You know, he did action films in the 70s that had 38 minutes of music, you know, in a 2-hour film. And then by the 90s, it got to this point where everyone, you know, a 1-hour 20 movie was 120 minutes of music. Face Off was 129 minutes of music for that, and it's 130 minutes long. Wow. And that was that sort of style, you know. So Bourne was very much me trying to sort of, you know, do anything I could to find a way of identifying myself in Hollywood. And Doug Liman was a very willing, more than willing. He sort of guided me there as well, very much in his mm-hmm. wonderful madness.
And that score, I guess maybe I might be reaching too much, but you know, Bourne was a very efficient person. So what you're talking about is paring down the orchestra to small players to maybe replicate that efficiency. I think it made a lot of waves, and I still love the guitar riffs in those themes. I mean, they're in the film. There's this one film where all the agents are being activated. You know, there's a guy on a Vespa and he gets the call, and it's just, the music does a lot to that. It's so amazing to see what was done with less, because you're right. I mean, well, it speaks to the efficiency of the character, I think.
Yeah, I don't, it's funny. You have to understand, I think a lot of times instinct kicks in. And things you don't necessarily realize you're doing could be, when they work, they're often because they match some kind of characteristics of character or the story. I do, the only one I really remember was I had a very fast moving cue for the scene at the bank, and Doug walked in, and as Bourne's walking away from the bank, you know, it's a chase. So I had chase music as one would do, you know, kind of very tense, exciting music. And Doug said to me, look what he's doing. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, he's walking. It sounds like he's running in the music, but he's walking. So why are you doing that? So that's when I redid that one completely. And that became a big part of the sound, was that he never really, it was a confidence, yeah. Efficiency I hadn't thought of, but that's true. And so I slowed all of the chase music down to, it's like chasing at a walking speed. And that was a big key to opening up the whole thing, yeah. But the rest of it often was just me doing sort of the opposite of what everybody else would do, which is dangerous and difficult, I thought it wasn't working, most of it, really. We were on the dub stage trying to fix that stuff because it was written in a way that didn't work very well with sound effects and things, and everybody had to sort of try and figure their head how to do it. But that's what Doug likes about filmmaking. He likes to try and, well, he tries to make his film engage the way he wants a film to engage him. And he wants it to be different. He wants everything to be different. And it's not hugely different. If you look at it, it's just touches, really. It's just, but I think it speaks of his, you know, sort of slightly angled vision of everything. And then so the tone becomes slightly unusual. And it just, all it requires is a few things every kind of minute to just keep you in a slightly different expectation of what if the film rolls out exactly the way everybody knows how it goes, if any story does, if everything is exactly how we expect it, there's a relaxation that happens. If you can keep people slightly, not even surprised, it's not about surprising them, it's just keep them a bit intrigued because things aren't working quite the way you expect. And that could be on every level, everything from costume to the script, to the, you know, the lighting, to the camera. You know, this was the beginning of people really sort of starting to use camera in a very different way. And then with the music as well, we did things with the music so that you wouldn't get the comfortable ride sometimes that you would expect from those kind of films. And so just enough of those all the way along, you know, I think keep people very engaged. And if you can get people engaged, then they grow it. They get a feeling that the story is worth hearing, which it's very hard in a time, especially now, when there's so much going on. It's very, very hard to engage in stories because you have so much choice. And I would say that, you know, that's going to be the problem, I think, for everybody making entertainment at the moment, is like, you know, you are really in a big crowd now, so you better make it good. Mm-hmm. But it is wonderful. I mean, there's a lot of very good material coming out now. There's some better TV and shows and series and things than I've ever seen in my life.
And I can agree with that, because on the consumer end of this conversation, sometimes, this even goes back to Airplanes, there'd be so much content out there that it might take me 30 minutes of scrolling just to figure out what I want to watch. And by the time I get something, it's 11 o'clock, I got work tomorrow, or put my daughter to bed, whatever it is. Well, let's jump into the meat and potatoes, or the English breakfast of this conversation. Solo, A Star Story, has a vinyl release through Mondo Records. But this came sort of just after you teased something of the expanded release, the digital expanded release of Solo. Were there discussions about trying to get the expanded on vinyl, or when did either of those two make themselves known?
I'm not really sure. To be truthful, my assistant, Batu, is much more passionate about these things than I am. I have a record player. I'm obviously aware that vinyl has become a big thing. I would say that there is so much music in solo that I was very happy for the digital version to have everything there. And we're starting to do that with some other scores. And other scores, I'm not doing that because it's funny. I looked at somebody said, you know, a record company said, could you look at this and maybe we could put out the whole score? And I had a look at it. And what I'd put out in the 45 minutes in the original score was that was fine. The rest of it was just bollocks. It really was. It was all more of the same. It was just a lot of kind of, you know, I don't know, just a. It was just dull. The rest of it was dull, and I'd put out the first one with the only good bits in it. So I was quite happy with that. I think with solo, there was such a lot of material there that it was great to put that out. Whether you know anyone can sort of, you know, records are interesting because they require a different listen to vinyl. It requires a different approach to music. You know, it's very easy to put music on these days, and it will, you can put things on that will run and never stop all day. You know, it's sort of continuous playlist of everything. With a record, you have to be very decisive about it. It's like, I'm going to listen to this side, and in possibly 20 minutes, you're going to have to get up and turn it over. Yeah. And if you want to listen to one song or you hate one song, it's very hard to get and skip that song. You know, it's something that you have to, there's a ritual to it that I'd forgotten since, you know, I mean, I as soon as I could get to cassettes, as a kid, I did. I mean, I remember starting on records, but I remember listening over and over to a record of Jean-Michel Jarre. And that was wonderful because that ran sort of very continuously front to end, and it was each side was quite long. But then I would get very frustrated with so many other things that once cassettes came in, I would run everything onto cassettes as soon as I could, even though the sound wasn't as good. So with this, I'm like standing back and saying, well, if people really want it on vinyl, sure. But it's not something that I think I would do. It's like I would want to listen to it, you know, at a run, and I wouldn't want to have to keep getting up seven times to turn it over. Sure. So, you know, I hope people enjoy it. I mean, I have my own feelings about, you know, listening to things off vinyl. There's lots and lots of technical reasons as to why it sounds good. And, you know, I could get into a giant argument with loads of audiophiles about that because they're idiots, a lot of them. And they really... they're not really quite aware what they're listening to, but what they're not accepting is that listening to music is a sensual experience, all senses. You know, your skin. That's why clubbing is fabulous, because you know you're there and your muscles and your skin is being played music. It's listening to the music. Your body is listening to the music. You put on headphones, you miss all of that. You know, if you listen to your music on a phone, it's about your relationship with this thing that is attached to you. I think if you listen to records, you're getting a whole bunch of extra people call it warmth, but it's, you know, rumble and things like that, but those frequencies are there. They're definitely there. It's not that the record sounds better, it's that listening to a record gives you this additional set of harmonics and subharmonics and things. And so the difference between sort of the final product as we listen to it in here coming off of 192 digital and the actual record is that the record adds things. And that's fine. And it's a very sensual experience because of that, I think. It has this, it's an extra sensual experience, that's what I should say. Whereas if you listen to a CD, yes, it's kind of purer to what we heard in the studio, but it's got certain frequencies cut off. Yes, but it's also not got those other things added. And if you listen to 24 track tape, there's a patina that it adds. There's compression. There's all sorts of other things that get added. But the difference between one microphone and another one is distortion, but there's distortion that's good. And so So records and vinyl are about distortion of the true sound. But the true sound isn't, there's no true sound. I mean, we try and get it to sound as good as we can, but compared with actually standing by an orchestra playing, it doesn't sound very good.
Fair enough.
You know, in the right, I heard a piece at the beginning of last year when we could travel. It was in January last year. In Canada, and it was in a beautiful hall, and it was 27 singers a cappella, and they were moving around the stage, and they were singing this incredible sort of polyphonic music. And not only did the hall sort of give me the 27 voices separately but blended, but as they moved you could hear things changing in a way that the real sort of 360 degrees of sound was ever evolving in a way that I've got Atmos. So I'm sitting in a studio at the moment with my Atmos system, you know, and everything.
Wow.
And it just isn't, even that isn't what, you know, reality is. Our ears are just so good at hearing, you know, a really fascinating one is if you put a bit of, like plasticine in your ear with a hole where your ear is, but you cover up the shape of your ear, that foldy bit, all those weird foldy bits, you cover those up, you'll be able to hear perfectly well in one plane, which is you'll be able to hear behind you, to the left, to the right, front, you'll be able to spot everything. You will not be able to hear below or above. And that's what the folds of the ear are. So that tells me that, you know, evolution has given us a requirement to listen to sound in such an interesting and it's obviously an evolutionary trait to keep us alive. We could hear things coming for a long, or we could hear things to attack, things to capture. It's a survival technique that we've turned into this wonderful sensual experience. And so I add kind of the idea of vinyl as this additional sense is being added to vinyl, the sound of vinyl that, you know, really aren't there.
Well, I have to say that your music is a sensual experience, and whether it's two discs or 20 to make you feel better, I wouldn't skip any tracks. There's something great about listening to your music and letting it play through. But picking up on the word you used, overcranked, I picked up on that in Solo. But I was watching it again last night, and there's the train heist scene. And I love the flourishes that you give to the themes and the characters, but it almost feels like whoever said that you overcrank your music, I don't know, maybe that message got to the editing crew, because it felt like that was pulled back just a little bit when it should have helped propel the energy. What kind of discussions that you have with the director or the audio editor about how to place it and how that balance between dialogue and sound effects works?
It's a complicated situation, because there's a giant team of sound effects editors who have put together, you know, absolute realism and hyper realism, and, you know, and the efficiency of just having very clear vocal dialogue tracks. You know, there's nothing worse than, you know, not being able to hear dialogue because you can't really make it out. You know, I mean, sometimes it sort of doesn't matter what they're saying, but that can become very frustrating for the viewer, because you think you're supposed to hear something and you don't know if you've missed it and if you've missed important information. If the filmmaker says, well, it doesn't matter, the danger is that the audience doesn't know that, you know, so it'd be better not to have that line of dialogue there. They should have changed the edit. If you have music that's pounding away all the time, it depends how it pounds. You know, if it pounds in a way that you get the feeling of it, but you can still hear dialogue, and that's fine. If the music is kind of overcranked, in my case, it's probably telling a lot of the story itself. And I think that's probably what I overdo. And then everyone's in the dub, on the dub stage with all the elements, they've got the dialogue, the sound effects, and the music. And they're trying to sort of make up their minds. Well, here we should push this one thing. Here we should push the sound effects. You know, realism in cinema is the big question. As soon as you have music, you lose realism. And so, if if everyone's trying to create realism, the one thing you don't want is music or busy music. So I think that's, you know, yes, I certainly would have had it louder. I probably felt that during that scene we could have used the music for more, you know, sort of for a bigger kinetic effect. But you know, it's a team sport, and you know, you have to pass the ball.
Well said, well said. Well, from the time when they meet with Dryden in his yacht until they get through the mall, it's almost nonstop music. And so when you work with John Williams' music, when you work with him specifically, how do you work to make things feel analogous? How do you work to make things feel fresh? Because I noticed there was a lot of percussion, a lot of higher pitched brass, a lot of fun elements in the sabak game. But I guess, yeah, how did you take the palette that was there and help, you know, work to expand it?
Yeah, it was a hellishly kind of frightening experience to, A, you know, get to work with John and walk into a situation where, you know, the Star Wars, you know, world was being opened up a little, sort of at really kind of at the beginning of it not being, you know, now we've got to the Mandalorian, we're realizing that, you know, this world will expand, no problem. But at the time, I think everyone was very nervous about it, and I was very nervous. I described it to somebody as, you know, walking through a minefield in clown shoes. You know, there was a very high likelihood that I would not I would not survive, you know, I felt, at least at the beginning. So I spent a lot of time before John had time to sort of come on, worrying about it, studying his stuff, worrying more, having studied his stuff. They gave me the short scores, you know, his original sort of sketch things of the first movies, the, you know, 77, 4, 5, 6. And it was extraordinary looking at them because it's all there. You know, it's just, you know, unbelievable how elegant and perfect it is. And so that made me depressed, and then I would write some things, and then I would look at his stuff, then I would get depressed. So I went through, you know, for several months of doing that, and then eventually he came on, and you know, and we talked, and he watched the film through, and we kind of spotted, although he says you don't really spot, he famously said you don't spot Star Wars movies, you start at the beginning and you end at the end, and there's you know, they never stop. But he looked all through the movie with us, and that was one of the most fascinating things, was to watch him as a storyteller kind of analyze the movie, you know. And that the advantage of that is you get this new view on it, as any filmmaker gets when a new audience member comes in, but with somebody who with such a kind of a deep understanding of storytelling, and what music can do for it. So he basically looked through the movie with us. He then went away and wrote, he was there to write a tune. He wrote two. One became sort of Hans' theme, and the other one was, you know, what we sort of, I kind of called the, you know, the searching tune, and I used both of them. And once he'd done that, it was such a relief. I tell you, it was such a relief. I sort of knew almost immediately how it would work. It all sort of fell into place. I'd worried so much about it. I'd written a bunch of things, and I didn't really know whether they were going to be right. And some of them were obviously not going to be right, but a lot of them actually did work once I had John's material. So we then, you know, we mocked up in the, you know, I write everything in demo form in Logic and with lots of samplers and everything else. So it sounds as close as I can get it to the final orchestration. It allows me also to add these kind of, you know, other elements that we don't have to record at the same time as the orchestra. I can program things in or record them separately. And once I'd started to put all his material into my system and taken his orchestrations and just fleshed them out in my, you know, my world, as it were. I could then use bits of it. I could take things and I could change it more easily. I could integrate it in lots and lots of different ways. So, you know, that was his material. And then I just sort of grew everything out from that towards my tunes, my ideas and things, and in from my ideas into his material. So it sort of, you know, it really was just about getting comfortable with the idea that John had made, you know, these very, very wonderful, effective, you know, tunes that completely spoke of the character and spoke of the movie. And once that was there, everything else seemed to just, I don't know, make sense. It's difficult to describe. It's probably just confidence of knowing that he's put these, you know, very effective and classic, you know, sort of bricks down. And you see the brick and you know that it's level. And then so, you know, to build out from there, it's like, okay, thank God. I've got one good flat surface that's perfect. Now I can build everything else around that, and the top, I can use that as my level, you know, my reference level. It was, you know, until then it was still just a kind of a muddy pit that I wasn't sure if things were gonna survive. You know, I don't know why I went into a building analogy there, but.
Well, I'm actually in architecture myself, so I can relate. That makes a lot of sense.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I have to tell you, I was not too kind to the movie the first time I saw it, but I've seen it probably 16 times since. Never had a problem with the music. And I think there was just something about how the conveniences just seemed to keep lining up. Felt like things were handed versus being earned. So I had that narrative problem, but I've warmed to it completely. I've done a 180 and
it's sort of not a Star Wars film. I came to the conclusion it's not really a Star Wars film. It's a film about people who seem to base their life on a Star Wars story, you know, and we're doing this other thing. I mean, one of the things that isn't in Solo that I think is actually interesting, and watching The Mandalorian, there's a thing to that, which is there's absolutely no mysticism whatsoever in Solo. And one of the big things of Star Wars and even Mandalorian is this, there's a mysticism, obviously the Force, but that religious aspect to it, the magical isn't there in Solo. I love it because it's more like, it's closer to Italian Job, really. It's kind of, it's a heist movie with interesting characters. And I like that. And they're in a world that's just, you know, forever sort of shifting with very, very human. It's all very human. And there's nothing very, but there's never that magical quality to it. There are no gods in it. As opposed to, you know, Star Wars is a religious story. It's a, you know, it's a Christ story. It's a, you know, it's an ancient mythical world. And that means anything's possible in the same way as a lot of these kind of wonderful fantasy films give you. Whereas Solo is a very down to earth story, even though it's set in this other world. I think, you know, it could be a, you know, a $5 million film set in the East End of London, you know,
true,
with, you know, gangsters and people trying to make their way and people trying to survive and you know, the usual backstabbing and it, that's really what it is. It's painted in this very you know, fantastical world. So I understood the reaction. I also think that, you know, the main problem was that why did they put it out 5 months after the last Star Wars? It was just crazy to do that. And I can't tell you what we all went to kill ourselves to get it out on the day it was supposed to come out. And that really, I think, backfired on everyone. So.
Well, you know, one of the things that makes an artist are the nuances or little identifiers. you know, I having watched it recently, there's a part on the spice mine planet where there's a laser blast and you see the reflection of the laser in Chewie's eyes. And it's just something that you notice after digging, you know, watching it over and over. So if anything, what type of little flourishes do you add to things that, you know, you may have a theme, but then when you tweak it a little more, add a little bit more to it, make it, you know, more John Powell or more whatever it is.
Yeah, you're describing things that you saw that were never in the version I saw.
Okay, fair enough.
Probably. You're, okay. I scored a movie that had, you know, half of the visual effects not done, and they were. I went to the set when they were shooting to go and meet Ron Howard, and it was absolutely fascinating. And I was on the set with the visual effects supervisor, who's really nice, and you know, we both basically geeked out about the same age, and it was like, did you ever believe that when you were, you know, when you were 15 and you saw, you know, Star Wars, that you'd one day be working in a star? And he was like, no, I can't believe that I'm in charge of all of this. And he's very brilliant. And so I was sitting there with the set that they shot the train scene on, which is this kind of giant thing on legs that could move any way, and stuntmen were falling off left, right, and center. And it was amazing, and all green screen around it. And then I worked with it, and it looked like shit on all of the copies. Absolutely looked like shit on it, because you could see everything. You know, it was they would try and patch things in, you know, as they went. But there was so much work. The sound, the visual effects guys absolutely killed themselves to get that film done. And so it looked terrible, and so I work on that whole thing, and then I get to the premiere, and I watched it in the premiere, and I'm telling you, this is bizarre. I sat there, I was watching, I was going, wow, where did they shoot this? Because this looks, and I forgot that it was done on a sound. It was completely believable in a way that I had not been able to believe it up till then. So you have to understand that, you know, on these films, you're not getting the audience's experience of it. You're having to sort of really, you know, pray that everybody's going to get everything right. And boy, did they in that case. My thing is I've got a lot of, you know, interest in thematic development. So I did sort of talk to John about what the themes meant to him, the old ones. So I was trying to be very, very respectful of when we used them and why we used them. And then the meaning of the themes that he wrote for this one, and then the meaning of the themes that I wrote as well. What exactly were they there for? So every time people hear themes, it's very deliberate. But you may also not be hearing the themes, because I might be using it in a more developmental way, which is you can take things and you can use them retrograde, which is basically flip backwards, or inverted, which is flipped vertically over the pitch, and you can get a lot of really interesting material out of developing, you know, taking, you know, material and then developing it in a way that is not about people ever being able to recognize it, but it's about utilizing it in a way that is part of, in the back of your head, I think, you know, that it's coming from the same world. It's just been sort of changed and developed in such a sort of a sometimes kind quite distant way, but it's still from the same family. That was what my interest was all the time. So, but I was also at the same time, I wasn't gonna be too frightened of the material sometimes. So that's why, you know, you get versions of very, very famous pieces of John's music. You get them pretty, you know, I took liberties. And sometimes I had to be persuaded to do that, because I was a little nervous about it. But the filmmakers were very keen. Kathleen Kennedy was the one who was pushing it. No, let's see how far we can go. And it's great to see, you know, Ludwig, because I think he's gone in this great direction on Mandalorian. I like to think that we sort of opened the door a little bit to that. But he's really gone for it. And it's great, because it really takes the sound of, you know, Star Wars into its own world now. And so that was my concern, I think, at the time, was how far could we push the sound away from what people expected, knowing that, you know, diehard fans would have a problem with the with the story and with the characters. You know, it was a question: is how far do we push the fans away from what they're expecting? And the story already was doing that. There was a lot of material was doing that already. Should the music, how far could the music go away from what was expected? And so I hope we found the right middle ground for sort of allowing one foot in the, you know, on into the future, but also holding it closely enough to sort of everyone's heart.
Well, I could see and both appreciate the apprehension to do so, because I think of something like Michael Giacchino, who scored the Star Trek film. I spoke to him about trying to use the theme too early, and his response was, well, they needed to earn it, because when we did use it earlier, it felt cheated. But, you know, I could see what you would want to please some fans who are, if they don't have a couple of notes, they know it's not a Star Wars film. The film doesn't have the title crawl in the beginning and the fanfare. But, you know, I think the line that you walked as carefully, like you said, you had to be persuaded or, you know, dissuaded. I think you walked it perfectly, because it does walk the tightrope very well.
Good. Phew.
Well, can we talk about two quick things? On the expanded release, there's a track called Chicken in the Pot. And I want to know which version of Chicken in the Pot you like better, the one in the film or one on the release? Because there's two different voices. The choral from the movie versus the one on the soundtrack is different. And then can you tell us what the JP and Stormtrooper JP054 karaoke stands for?
Oh, God.
Sorry.
Well, Chicken in the Pot, that was basically, I was trying to, you know, when the original directors were on, they had a couple of sort of source cues that they needed. So I started working on those early. And then it all changed. And one of the source cues was light by Ron, when one of the versions, which I'd just sort of been doing crazier and crazier versions. And so the version that ended up being useful, which was the one source cue that was needed, was this one that they had only been described to me as like, it's a singer and the other singer is in a pot and it looks like a chicken. So Chicken in the Pot. I did the first version I can't remember which language it was that I found online. I just wrote some words and then had them translated in one of these sort of translators. And then Disney pointed out that they might not necessarily own that particular language, even though it was a language from the films, we then had to have an official translation to a language that was approved by Disney and owned by the Star Wars sort of franchise, so that I had to re-record it. So I re-recorded it, and that's the one that we have in the film. That's the one that's on the album, because we just got to this point where we had to release the album, so that got put on the album. And then a few days after that, they were on the dub stage saying, you know, I'm not sure that voice works as well. Could you try something else? So then I went the other way and did a very, very low voice for the chicken, as opposed to a high voice for the chicken. And that's what's in the film. So we thought, at the very least, we'll put that on the expanded edition, so you've got that. Which one I prefer, I don't know. I mean, it probably works better in the film with the low voice, but I always have a fond memory of the original, which is, you know, with just a high voice, because it seems funnier to me. But and then there was this other source cue that I had to do, another piece that I'd done for source cues early on, I just had to send something like really quick to the directors at the time, and they said. And I said, well, I can get a singer tomorrow. And they would lie on the fence. No, just do it yourself. Don't just do it yourself. We don't care. So I just sang and I've got a shitty voice, but I sort of processed it. And I was just making up any old bollocks as I was going along. And that just somehow needed to, right at the last minute on the final film, we needed Ron said, have you got any more source music or something, that we just need a bit of source music in there. We didn't have any music in one scene, just something behind that scene. So I pulled a few things out and I laughed hearing this. I thought, well, try this. And so we managed to stick it in as source music. And so there I was singing in a Star Wars film. That amused me, but I was never, ever going to let that see the light of day. Until the expanded edition came along. And then I don't know, I just thought, well, it'd be funny if we stick that in there, and just so that they know. And I just thought it'd be funny if at the weekend, some of these stormtroopers just like do gigs, do weddings and things. And so that's why it's a stormtrooper, I think. I honestly can't remember. You know, the great thing about these worlds where you can invent anything and make up any sort of thing and try and fit it in, but you're also trying to fit it in with lore, L-O-R-E, the story, because there's a bunch of this stuff that is very hard to keep track of, because it's in books and it's in comics and graphic novels and in TV specials that you never saw or in animated series I've never seen. So I had to be very careful sometimes about what I was doing with tunes and things in case, but that was one that that was just a complete sort of piece of getting stoned and finding something funny, really. So sorry, there's not really much more to it sometimes than that. It's not okay. These things are not intellectual, towering intellects thinking very carefully about stuff. They're just people being stupid sometimes.
And as a consumer, I'm lapping it up, so this is great. So I have one last question for you. You can answer it, two questions. You can pick which one you want to answer. Are we getting a Solo 2? And the other question is, your music happens so fast, so without having a musical background, all I can ask is, how do you do that, and how long does it take to do maybe a 3-minute, like the last 3 minutes of the 12 parsecs track?
I'll answer the first one, which is I have no idea.
Okay. That's the easy way out. I appreciate it. Well, I adore the time with you. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a blast. And if you do get to take another trip to a galaxy far, far away, I hope, I wish you the best of luck. Just grab your hydro spanner.
Oh God, I'm gonna have to look that up now.